right. Before we get into today, we're going to be focusing on philosophy of congregational worship, kind of generally applying the biblical material and developing some philosophical principles. Before we do that, I want to spend some time discussing how congregational worship has developed through church history. Okay, so this hour is primarily going to be congregational worship and church history, with a particular focus at the end on Baptists and worship. I read through your questions last night and found them very, very interesting, very helpful. I had already planned on dealing with most of what was asked, and things that I hadn't, I'm going to try to pull in. One of the things that was very interesting to me was that I think everybody had at least one question about music. Now, this class is not a class on music specifically. It's a class on congregational worship. Come on in. But it just serves the point that obviously is the hot button, right? And some of you asked, why is it such a hot button, which we'll get to. But one of the reasons is that music, like I said yesterday, is kind of a window through which someone's entire philosophy can be seen. So you can tell somebody's entire philosophy of worship just by their music. So that's a big reason. But a couple people asked about culture and how, you know, someone asked, should culture influence our worship? I think was the question. What we're going to see during this hour is that it's not should culture affect worship. Culture affects worship. There's no doubt about it. There is an interconnectedness between religion and culture, between worship and culture. It's unavoidable. And basically, as we look at the history of worship throughout the course of church history, what we're going to be tracing is the interaction between culture and politics and society, you know, what is going on in the secular world, and the church, because they always interact with one another. People often misunderstand the nature of culture and how it does and should and can relate with the church. And I think this particular issue is one of the issues that if we get it right, if we understand what culture is and how it has developed throughout history, we will go a long way to answering a lot of the debate. So if part of what you're wondering is the whole music issue and what's appropriate and CCM and classical and what all is this and what's appropriate, this hour is going to be important. It's history. Boring, right? No. Understanding this will help you understand the debate and will give you a lot of answers. People confuse, for instance, the concepts of folk culture, pop culture, high culture. You know, if I were to ask you to define those, I think we'd get a billion different answers, and probably all wrong. And some people assume classical music means kind of highbrow. Well, sometimes it does, but not inherently. So we're going to talk about that. First point we need to understand is this. Religion and culture have always been connected to one degree or another throughout history. A society's religious views influence the way it expresses itself in culture. All right? What is culture? Here's a succinct definition of culture. Culture is the tangible expression of a society's collective worldview. Culture is the tangible expression of a society's collective worldview. So how a particular community looks at life, looks at morality, God, mankind, justice, etc., expresses itself externally in their popular art, or literature, or philosophies, or music. So, how a society looks at all those kinds of things is kind of intangible, right? You ask somebody, what is your worldview? What is your religion? Well, that's something that's internal. It's in the mind. How can you know what a particular society thinks about God, about the world, about man? You can see it through their culture. A culture is a visible expression of a society's religion, whether it's a formal religion or not. Okay? T.S. Eliot wrote a book on culture called Christianity and Culture. And he said this, no culture can appear or develop except in relation to a religion. In other words, a society's beliefs about God affect their view of the world, and these beliefs will manifest themselves in cultural expression. Okay? So, yes, sir.
What was the name of that book again?
Christianity and Culture by T.S. Eliot. Excellent book. If you want to understand culture, that's a good first place to start. So a society's religious views, whether or not it's some kind of formal religion, okay, religion doesn't have to be formal, you know, Christianity is formal, but it could just be, you know, atheism is a religion. Agnosticism is a religion. Okay? So a religion or worldview or philosophy, whatever a particular society thinks about these things is expressed visibly, tangibly through its culture. So through music, literature, plastic arts, you know, visual arts, poetry, etc. Okay, that's culture. Visible expression of a society's worldview. Okay? So keep that in mind as we trace the history of the church. We're going to trace the development of this kind of interaction. All right, the early church. Number one, the early church. We've talked about this a little bit, so we'll just briefly run through it. Yes, sir?
I have a question, obviously. perhaps somebody says that they believe that they can worship outside of the church, like in just like the wilderness.
Yes.
Is that scriptural? Is that sinful? Or what would you say to that person?
Good. Yeah, that applies to our discussion last hour. Yeah, good. Someone says, boy, I just worship in the wilderness and I don't need to go to church. Is that basically the thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Number one, yes, they can worship in the wilderness, right? That's lifestyle worship. But is there not a command to gather together to worship as well? Yes. So if they deny the mandate to gather together, Hebrews 10:25, if they deny the mandate to praise the Lord in the assembly, then they're disobeying the Lord. So it's not wrong to say, I worship the Lord in the woods when I go hunting. Yeah, you do. And you worship the Lord when you play soccer, and you worship the Lord when you drink orange juice. But there is a biblical mandate and example to gather together in local churches for the purpose of worship, among other things. Man.
And what if a person can't find a church?
Well, we need to be involved in a local church. So, I mean, you know, I can't really take the time to go into all that, but yeah, you know, do whatever you need to do to be in a good local church. Start a church, you know. Okay, so, the early church. The first thing is what we mentioned last hour. As the church began, it was natural for them to continue Jewish practices in a lot of ways. There is good reason to believe that the earliest church carried over even some of the kind of formal liturgies of the Jewish synagogue You know, the certain prayers, the certain hymns, the certain order, the way that they did things. That doesn't mean, you know, it's mandated and we have to do things that way, but they did it that way. Okay? Because of that fact, you remember Judaism was, you know, the people of Israel was a theocracy. So culture and religion were like inseparable, right? I mean, everything was under the rule of God for the Jews. Once we get to the period of the church, that's not the case anymore. We've got society and culture as one thing, and then the church and religion as another thing. But in the early church, it was still, you know, like I said, the hymns that they sung, the psalms that they sung, the way that they did things were still probably Jewish, which means they developed in a God-fearing kind of culture. Okay? It was not long, however, before the church began to develop a subculture of its own. And this especially increased as they brought in Gentiles, and so, you know, there wasn't a mandate to carry over the Jewish practices. But also as persecution increased, Christians were forced to move underground, to be in hiding. And that definitely would have affected their worship practices, including their music. They were fearful of being discovered. You may hear, I've read, you know, well, in the writings of the early church, they didn't use instruments, so we shouldn't use instruments. But why didn't they use instruments? Because they were in hiding. If they had a big brass offertory, you know, they're just asking for trouble. All right? So what was going on in their situation affected how they did things in terms of their church subculture. Okay, so when we're talking about the early church, number one, they were heavily influenced by Jewish culture originally. And then that began to weaken as the church spread and as persecution spread. Okay? You are reading, I mentioned this yesterday, a collection of documents called the Didache, which is a collection, a kind of a church handbook in these early years. And you will get a good picture of what things looked like in the early church. Okay, it's like first or second century. There's not full agreement about when the Didache was written, but it's like first or second century. Okay, next, the Middle Ages. The legalization of Christianity by Constantine in 313, and then its establishment as the official religion of the state in 380, significantly influenced the relationship between the church and culture. Okay, prior to that, the church was underground. Any music they did have was quiet. You know, they didn't want to draw attention to themselves. Once Christianity was legalized, and especially once it was made the official religion of the state, a lot changed. Some of it good, obviously there's no persecution anymore, but some of it bad. Because, you know, religion and the state, you know, the church and state was the same, there was a very, very much of a top-heavy, you know, rule with an iron fist kind of influence upon culture by the church. What is very interesting during this time period is that we go from an illegal religion to a power that influenced just about everything virtually overnight, right? I mean, here we have Christianity that's illegal and is being persecuted and people are being killed, and virtually overnight it becomes the most controlling influence in Western culture. How can that happen?
Because
Here's how it happened. A couple things. Number one, basically we're asking the question is, how did the Roman Catholic Church become what it was? And how did that influence biblical Christianity and how did that influence culture? Right? Roman Catholic Church, as it grew and as it is now, is heretical. How did that happen and how did it influence how the church did worship? Okay, number one. Now that Christianity was legal, churches started sprouting up all over the place. I mean, all throughout the Roman Empire. Because now you were expected to say you were Christian. Doesn't mean that people really were. Everybody became a Christian because it was the official religion of the state. They weren't really regenerate. They weren't really saved. But so there's churches popping up everywhere. So if there's churches popping up everywhere, and now a lot of new people saying they're Christians, but not a whole lot of real Christians, what's going to happen? You know, there's not enough time to train enough pastors to be able to lead these churches. So what happened was church leaders began to publish acceptable forms of worship for the churches to follow. So you've got all these churches popping up everywhere, and the truly regenerate church leaders begin to look at all these churches and say, boy, these churches are popping up all over the place. Everybody's saying they're Christian now, and we don't even have enough time to train pastors to properly lead these churches. So we need to start writing down proper forms, proper ways to worship the Lord. Initially, their motivation, I think, was honorable. They didn't want people to start worshiping in wrong ways because they were uninformed, because they were untrained, and possibly even unbelievers. But what that then developed into was church leadership with very strong authority about how the churches worshiped and set in stone ways, you know, this is how you must worship. Here are approved prayers. Here are approved hymns. Here are approved orders of worship. So you see why they were motivated to do it? It was probably good motivation to begin with, but it ended up being a bad thing. Second, because everybody's a Christian now, you know, by name only, congregations began to grow, and so they began to build huge buildings to accommodate the masses. Worship had to be organized very specifically because there were so many people. And so again, powerful church leaders began to formulate permissible liturgies for their churches. So you get these big grand buildings in order to accommodate all the people. And we've got, you know, if you've got five people sitting in the living room worshiping, you know, you don't need a whole lot of structure to that. But if you've got 5,000 people, you've got to have some order. And so the church leaders, and when I say church leaders, I mean, you know, not just the pastors of one local church. I mean people who kind of had authority over a lot of churches because they were springing up and there wasn't enough time to train all the pastors, began to formulate approved ways of doing things. Third, as heresy began to spread within Christianity, proponents of such errors would spread their falsity through hymns. Do you realize that? People spreading heresy would do so by putting it in song, because it would stick in people's minds and then the heresy would spread. And so church leaders were worried about that, and that gave them reason to further consolidate their power by demanding control over the church's music. So churches could only use those musical forms that were expressly sanctioned by the leadership. So, I mean, when we look at the Roman Catholic Church today, we see, you know, real top-heavy hierarchy, right? And we look at that and we say it's unbiblical, which it is. But you can see why it developed that way. It shouldn't have, but can you see why it did? I mean, the motivation initially was good. Boy, we've got all these people who say they're Christians now all over the place. We don't have enough time to train pastors. We've got heresy spreading in these hymns. We've got different kinds of worship all over the place that are not really biblical. Boy, we need to take control of this and make sure things are happening biblical. So we're going to start publishing approved lists of hymns and approved ways of doing things. And so their motivation initially was good, but it developed into this top-heavy hierarchical structure that obviously turned into what is today the Roman Catholic Church. Fourth, since Christianity became the official religion of the state, virtually everyone was baptized into the church and considered a believer. I mean, everyone. Everyone in this time period was, by name, a Christian. You know, just about everyone. They, you know, not many of them were regenerate. Not many of them were really Christians, but they said they were. So what this did, if everyone in society is a Christian, then it gives the church leadership great power and influence. Because people are going to listen to their pastors. People are going to listen to their church leadership. And if everybody in society does that, the church leadership has quite a bit of power. So these church leaders became really kind of nobles of the empire. And because many of these men were unregenerate and corrupt, they you know, gained significance, they gained power, they gained wealth, they took for themselves vast properties, and there was excessive, you know, pomp and circumstance, and boy, here are the leaders of our society, the church leaders. Okay, so, you know, the legalization of Christianity, while it was a good thing in that it stopped persecution, really is the cause of why things developed into the Roman Catholic Church. Lost count. Number five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Added to this was the fact that these church leaders were essentially covenant theologians who equated Israel and the church and therefore looked to the Old Testament traditions to formulate their theology and liturgy. So they soon developed into an errant theology of priests and sacrifices and mandatory pomp and circumstance in worship forms. And so over a relatively short span of time, the simple worship practices of the early church were transformed into spectacular ceremonies, you know, with lavish furnishings and grandiose pageantry. Because they were looking to the Old Testament law to give them instructions on how to do church. So all of these factors combined to form a powerful body of bishops that not only controlled the church's teaching and practice, but also held strong influence over politics and culture. One author said this, in the millennium between 500 and 1500, the church, however errant, because they were errant, they did start to get errant theologically, was the strongest force in Western culture. This happened virtually overnight. Now, the church's influence over culture during this period had both positive and negative effects. The positive effect is that because the church controlled culture, pagan influences were kept out from culture. Whether it was high culture or folk culture, you know, paganism was kept out because the church controlled culture. The church even attempted to spread its influences over pagan culture. We can see that in the Crusades. Okay? So the thing you got to keep in mind now, during the Middle Ages, who controlled culture? The church, which was the Roman Catholic Church, which began right but developed into wrong, but even though it was the Roman Catholic Church, it is still a, you know, it is still a theistic view, you know, a biblical theistic view of God at least. They began to get salvation wrong. They began to formalize worship for all those reasons we talked about. But it was still a Bible way of looking at God and life that was controlling culture during this time. So that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. Regarding music specifically, high art was nurtured in the church. Almost all expressions of high art during this time are sacred. You know, the classical music, quote-unquote, of this time was sacred, all of it, because that was what was nurtured in the church. The church even had an influence over folk art. And we're going to talk about the difference between these in a moment. But the point here is the church controlled culture. It controlled high culture. It controlled folk culture. A biblical way of looking at God and life, which Roman Catholicism still maintained, although they developed into heresy, but they still had a biblical way of looking at God and life, controlled culture. Okay, now, the Reformation. Yes, ma'am.
When you say state religion, are you talking about like Europe or I don't know what?
Yeah, you think of the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, they controlled all of Western civilization, you know. Okay. So we're talking, you know, Germany, Spain, France, Italy, you know, England, you know, the whole. Think back to your world history classes. Okay, Reformation. Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the wall at the door of the church in Wittenberg in what year?
1595, I think.
1517. Important date, significant date for you to know. Not for this class, but for life. When he did that, he not only sparked a theological reformation, but he also led the way for a new interaction between church music and culture. So during the Middle Ages, the church controlled culture, it controlled high culture, it controlled folk culture. In the church itself, high culture was nourished. Now, let me take a... I need to take a little break here and explain what I mean by these terms, all right? Because there's a lot of confusion when we talk about high culture and folk culture. High culture is the professional art music, right? It's stuff that average people can't do. It's very, very high in quality. It's beautiful, it's excellent, it's God-glorifying, but it's not accessible to the average Joe. Or in this case, you know, Giuseppe. All right? You all know the composer Giuseppe Verdi? Giuseppe Joe Verdi Green? His name was Joe Green. All right, so high culture is high in quality but not accessible. Folk culture is the culture of the people, of the common person. It's usually not written down. It's usually oral because people can't read music. You know, they just pass it on from generation to generation. Because of that, the bad stuff is kind of weeded out. You know, only that which is really good remains in folk culture. So still, you know, most of true folk culture is really, really good, but it's also really, really accessible. Did I spell accessible? High culture is really, really good. It's of a higher quality in terms of complexity, but it's inaccessible. During the Middle Ages, the church controlled all of culture because everybody had a kind of theistic worldview. Okay? So even folk culture was good because because the worldview, the religion, the philosophy of the day was Christian. Now, I say that with quotes because not, you know, most people were not really truly regenerate, but they still had a theistic worldview. So it controlled everything, but what was in the church was high culture. I mean, the people didn't sing. You know, it was the choirs, it was the great, I mean, it was wonderful music. You had your huge choirs of trained musicians, you know, huge, huge brass antiphonal groups and all this stuff. What Martin Luther was really burdened about was that the congregation needs to be involved. You know, part of his burden in the Reformation was that you know, everything was up here and the priests and the hierarchy, and the people were just, you know, kind of down here just attending and watching. He wanted the words of Scripture to be on every tongue. He wanted the music of the church to be congregational in nature. But he also wanted it to be high quality. He was a musician. He was a poet. And so he really made great strides in the area of church music. And this is what he did. He took the quality of high culture and the more accessible forms, and he combined them with the best of folk culture, and he created a new kind of church music. Specifically, he created the chorale, which is similar to today's hymn. Okay, so he said, listen, he said, the church has been nurturing all of this great music, but the common people can't do it. We need to maintain the quality of that, but we need to make it as accessible as the folk music that people are singing, you know, in their living rooms and in the fields. And so he combined the two to create what we think of today as the hymn or the chorale. A couple common misconceptions about Luther. Number one, and this relates to this, have any of you ever heard, you know, Luther said, why should the devil have all the good tunes? You heard that? Anybody heard that? A couple of you? And what people use that to prove, supposedly, is, see, Luther said that we can take the devil's music and use it in church. And what they mean by that is, you know, music of paganism or something. Who would have been the devil in Martin Luther's mind? The Pope. That's who he considered the devil. What he was saying was, why should the devil, Roman Catholic Church, have all the good music? We still need to keep that. He got rid of any of the lyrics that were expressing heresy. He replaced them with biblical lyrics. So he was very, very concerned that the quality of the music still be maintained. But he also very much wanted it to be accessible for the common person, which leads to the second misconception. Martin Luther used bar music. Wow. I didn't know that would be that controversial. You right back there? Anybody heard that one? Martin Luther used bar music? Again, to prove, supposedly, hey, we should be able to use the music of bars in worship. I am here to tell you today that yes, Martin Luther used bar tunes. But what are bar tunes? What's that? No, that's not exactly what it means. That's a good question, though. It's related. A bar tune is a form of a chorale. It's and I won't get into too much of this. It's kind of technical, but you music students will understand this. It's a AAB form, meaning we've got one portion of music, we repeat it again, and then we've got a third form. So some a lot of hymns are like this. You know, you sing one portion of music. And, well, what we sang this morning was almost the same, except it was A-A-B-A. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, if we got rid of that, that's called bar form. And so yes, Martin Luther, and the reason Martin Luther used bar form is because it was very accessible. It was a form used in the folk music of the day. And so, yes, Martin Luther used bar music. But this is what it means when it says that there was bar music. Okay? So that's the big strides of the Reformation. That we take the wonderful quality of high culture and the accessibility of folk culture and combine them into the church so that people are singing things that they can handle, but it's also of very high quality. And then he also maintained having nice big choirs and stuff like that too in the church, because, you know, and we'll talk tomorrow especially about the strengths and weaknesses of you know, high music in the church and accessible, you know, hymns in the church. But he maintained both. Okay, let's talk about the Enlightenment. Okay, so we have Middle Ages, the church-controlled culture, high culture and folk culture, the Reformation, the church still controlled culture. Luther decided, let's take the most accessible of high and the best of folk, combine them, and turn them into a kind of music that people can sing that is also good. Then we get to the period of the Enlightenment. Okay, let me draw a little chart up here. Up until the 17th century, culture expressed itself, and what is culture? The tangible expression of a society's worldview. Culture expressed itself along two planes. What are they? We just talked about them. High and folk. High is the professional, really, you know, complex, good music. Folk is the accessible music of the people. That's also very good. Church controlled both. Prior to the 17th century, there is no such thing as secular culture, meaning culture controlled by a secular worldview. What is a secular worldview? A worldview that denies that there is such thing as a God. Up to this point, virtually everyone, or at least anyone with any influence, at least believed in a God and some form of a biblical God, although they weren't necessarily Christians. I don't intend to mean that. But they still used the Bible as kind of their source for an idea about God. So up till the 17th century, there was no such thing as secular culture. There was no such thing as pop culture. We'll explain what that means in a moment. It was only high culture, only folk culture. And the church controlled it. This all changed in the Age of Reason. Beginning in the 18th century, philosophers, and you will recognize some of these names, philosophers of rationalism, Voltaire, Rousseau, they began to slip in and have influence because the theology of the church had so weakened by this point. There was this gaping hole, and rationalism slipped into the hole. And yes, sir?
I think we skipped a point.
Yeah, I did on purpose because we're running out of time. Basically, Pietism, what it did was weaken the church's theology and left room for this. But we won't sit there too long. Basically, what rationalism did is it emphasized man. We can trust ourselves. We can trust reason. We can't trust supernatural. We can't trust religion. We need to trust ourselves. And as that began to permeate society, it began to influence culture, because culture is the tangible expression of a society's collective worldview. And so as society began to be secularized through rationalism, so did culture. Yes, sir?
Like, that's, I mean, that's human nature to trust self and not God, you know? So, I mean, like, how can this be true about these people this time we're talking about? But prior to this, this vast group of people called Christians,
yes,
even though they weren't regenerate, it right, wasn't true about them.
Yes, good question. Here's the difference. Prior to this time, people still believed in the supernatural. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but just naturally, because they weren't saved then.
Yeah, I mean, they still trusted themselves, they still sinned.
It was a distorted view of the supernatural.
Yeah, absolutely.
They probably believed in ghosts and their
Yes, you're exactly right. There's a lot of superstition, yes. I'm not saying that this was heaven, you know, that this was a necessary good time. I mean, there was, you know, peasants, you know, were poor and untrained, and there was a lot of problems. But people still had a belief in God and in supernatural, which ended in the Age of Reason. And that's the big difference. So here we've got the church controlling. Age of Reason, the church loses its influence. There's a distrust in religion. There's a distrust in God and in the supernatural. And so this is when secularism takes over as the driving force in culture. Prior to this time, the church controlled culture. But now the church has lost its influence, and secularism controls. This is when secular culture first begins. And so now the high culture of the day is no longer controlled by the church, it's now controlled by secularism, and very quickly wanes. I mean, this is like Romanticism, which stayed pretty good, but then interest in high culture, as evidenced today, you know, not many people really appreciate it. Okay? During this time, progress, pleasure are the most important things. This is the time when the term emotion is coined to describe just what I feel. And we're going to talk a little later about how that really changed how we view emotion, affection, that kind of thing. So the Enlightenment succeeded in dethroning Christian perspective, and it sent the culture of the church into exile. So organized religion no longer shaped culture. High culture broke off on its own from the church and eventually, you know, kind of plummeted into antiquity. Folk culture, so high culture, we eventually lost, basically. What happened to folk culture? With the Age of Reason came the Industrial Revolution. The steam engine, and all with that, and then the printing press, the steam engine, and everything that comes with that. With that came the invention of mass media. For the first time in history, you could deliver media to large, vast quantities of people relatively quickly. Now, prior to that, that just wasn't possible, right? Prior to the steam engine, you just couldn't get information. You couldn't transfer things very quickly. Well, now you can, including culture. So with secularism and now mass media, we have the introduction of what we know as pop culture. Pop culture, this is important as we understand the distinctions here. Pop culture cannot exist apart from mass media. because inherent in pop culture is commercialism. It's advertising. It's finding what appeals to the most people through mass media, producing that, and selling it. Prior to this time, you know, high music was written by, you know, it was financed by rich patrons who wanted good music. Now, music is being written to make a big buck. Music is being written to appeal to the masses, to appeal to the secular masses. Now, what happened was, because of mass media, and of course that spirals, and now we have a global community, right? Culture begins to spread, pop culture begins to spread, and what pop culture did is it destroyed the possibility of any new folk culture. Why? Because by definition, folk culture is the culture of one little group of people who are not being influenced by anyone else. Which before mass media, there was a lot of that. You've got little groups of people in England, for instance, who are developing their own traditions, who are developing their own musical forms. They're all oral. They're not written down. Someone says, hey, here's a new song. And if it's bad, if it's not really good quality, eventually it just kind of falls off the wayside. Someone says, hey, I've got this new song, and it's really good. And it gets refined as it gets passed, and it's good music. But now with pop culture, there's no such thing as not being influenced by other people. Now there's all of a sudden these little communities come, you know, railroad tracks, and trains are coming through, and people from other cultures are visiting, and you've got now these posters on the wall, hey, buy my music, and you've got, you've got advertising and pop culture, and everybody wants to make a big dollar off of this culture. So at this point, folk culture is replaced by pop culture. So now, post-Enlightenment, and this is how things stand today, we still have high art, right? High culture. We still have music being written today that's of complex quality. But it's secular. So inasmuch as it retains, inasmuch as the common grace of God is there, it still could be good, but it's not controlled by the church any longer. It's controlled by secularism. So that's what you think of when you think of, you know, new, quote-unquote, classical music being written today. Okay? And then we also have pop culture. Pop culture is commercialistic. Pop culture is intended to appeal to the most amount of people so that I can make a dollar. Okay? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, not the people, because prior to this, you know, unsaved people wrote music. You know, we're not talking about whether it's written by saved people or unsaved people. We're talking about the philosophy, the societal philosophy behind it. Okay? As a controlling influence. Now, because frankly, prior to this, some very ungodly people wrote some very good music. Right? So it's not about the person who wrote it themselves. But even, you know, for instance, Mozart was a sinful person. But he lived in a society that appreciated good music. So he lived a raunchy life, but he wrote music that was good. Because that is what was popular, and we're going to distinguish in a moment between popular and pop during that time.